People who market books like using the phrase make a splash. A book makes a splash when it gets talked about, when the news media report on it, when booksellers recommend it, maybe even when CBC's online book club selects it. Well, borrowing the splash idea, I can say Norman Doidge wrote a book that splashed and kept on splashing and continues to stir up the water. His book is called The Brain That Changes Itself. It's a book that changed a lot of minds. Dr. Doidge spread the word about how our brains do not resemble a computer or a machine. Instead, a brain is a living, reacting, changing organism. He succeeded in changing how many of us talk about the brain. But how deep does this idea go? And that change in metaphor from the machine to the living creature, what does that mean for how we treat ourselves and each other? Norman Doidge is with me in Toronto. I'm delighted to meet you.
It's great to be here.
Thank you so much. And the other thing I'm really delighted about is I thought you were an American, and I thought that meant we couldn't talk to you. And then someone said, well, he's at Columbia, but he's also at the U of D, so here you are.
Yep.
So thank you for your citizenship.
Thank you.
Has that altered your brain?
My citizenship?
Or being in Canada and
no,
the culture?
I'm a native of Toronto, yeah. So it formed my brain.
But a little later on, we may talk about how when you go from one culture to another, and not necessarily America to Canada,
sure,
it can be a brain shock as mm-hmm. well as a culture shock.
Yep.
But I wonder how personally you came to feel so strongly about the way people imagine the brain.
The model we had was that the brain was like a machine. That meant that there was it was made up of parts, and each part was seen to perform a single mental function in a single location. And this basically gave rise to what I've called the doctrine of the unchanging brain, because it meant that if something failed to develop properly, by definition, there was nothing could be done, because machines do many glorious things, but they don't grow new parts. They don't reorganize themselves. It meant if you had certain kinds of trauma, again, by definition, nothing could ever be done. If your brain was starting to waste away, there was nothing that could be done. So it gave rise to a kind of neurological nihilism, which in clinical practice I saw happening, having, you know, very negative effects, because, you know, genetics has been spectacular. But this machine metaphor got married to our new understanding of genetics and gave rise to this notion that our circuits are hardwired. That meant genetically predetermined and fundamentally inalterable after childhood or early youth. And it meant when patients didn't get better, increasingly colleagues would say, well, those problems, those depressions, those anxieties are therefore must be hardwired into them. And when patients with very similar disorders did get better, nobody mentioned anything about hardwiring. They said, great, this person's gotten better. My background is poetry, and I can tell a metaphor when I see one. And this was a metaphor that was beginning to conceal more than it was revealing. And I also come from a philosophy background, and I was never really quite taken with the modernist notion that it goes back to Galileo and Descartes, that the brain is best understood as like a machine.
Like a pump, right? That's
yes.
what Descartes said. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Descartes was imitating William Harvey. William Harvey discovered, who worked alongside where Galileo worked in the University of Padua, they were applying these mechanical laws of motion initially to the heavens and then to the little organs inside us, and he showed that the heart was a pump with vessels. That made a lot of sense, and a pump is a kind of a machine. Descartes applied that to the nervous system, and he was very persuasive. And it got to be the point that our best and brightest neuroscientists, and you may not believe this. I could understand it if you don't believe it, but really did think of it as a machine with parts. And people like Huxley would say, you know, we won't rest until we've explained every organ in the body as though it's a little machine inside us. And the language of neuroscience was very machine-like. And the language of, you know, when drug companies say that, you know, depression is, a chemical problem, and you know, we have these receptor sites, which are true. We do have receptor sites, and molecules come and turn them on like switches. That seemed to build up the notion of a machine. But, you know, the problem was, at a more fundamental level, this is no ordinary machine. In fact, it's not a machine, because what we've been able to discover is that thought and consciousness and mental experience actually change the structure of our brains. And no machine that we know does this. in other words, we discovered that the brain is neuroplastic. And the definition I use for that, the simplest definition I can come up with, is it's the property of the brain that allows it to change its structure and its function on the basis of mental experience, seeing and perceiving, thinking, imagining, and acting in the world.
Yeah. I wanted, just to get personal with you, something I always go to the acknowledgments before I begin a book. And you write, my editor, James H. Silverman, immediately intuited the importance of neuroplasticity and worked with me for over 3 years, spurring me on from the earliest parts of this project, taking updates on my travels, watching me, here we come, possibly horrified as I forgot how to write, while I internalized the language of neuroplasticity, hoping to grasp the subject on its own terms and then helping me to slowly reemerge speaking English.
Yeah.
If I'd been your editor, I wouldn't have just been horrified. I think I would have had a heart attack.
Well, it sort of got tense. I would immerse myself in the work of these people who, some of whom, you know, were in labs and never saw the light of day, and learned about this subject and developed, as always happens. Look, late 20th century scientists, early 21st century scientists are specialists. They usually get a particular window onto something and they immerse themselves in that window and that problem. And, you know, I typed a lot of the transcripts, but my wife at one point when I was falling behind, Karen helped type the transcripts, and she would come back and say, how is it possible for you to turn this into a chapter that everybody's going to understand because the language was so different? But I really did want to understand it on their own terms before I learned to translate it back. You know, I had a column in the National Post for 3 years on human nature, and so I got adept, I would say, at taking theoretical things and arcane things and translating them so that everyone could understand.
But did you really forget how to write?
Well, there was one chapter I did 30 times. You know, now people say it's a page-turner, but to get it to be a page-turner, it was actually very laborious. And, I mean, I had to integrate and digest, you know, vast. If you go into the references section of my book, it's unusual that there's a book that does well with the general lay public that has 100 pages of references in it. But you read the names of some of those and you'll get the sense of the language that I had to speak and translate. It was a massive undertaking in translation, in a way.
Tell me about your poetic connection and possibly how that has altered your brain or shaped it.
Well, ever since I was 16, I wrote a lot of poetry. And I have a book which I'm ready to publish. I published in the Canadian Forum when I was 16 years old, and I got a big boost. I won the Pratt, E.J. Pratt Prize at Margaret Atwood won and Ondaatje won at the University of Toronto. And Northrop Frye gave me a lot of recognition early on, so that very much shaped me. When it came to writing nonfiction about the brain, here was this problem that I was grappling with, that people had been caught in this metaphor, and it was actually doing harm. So what I tried to do, my poetic side kept wanting to describe everything metaphorically, but I had learned that that's actually a problem. And when I went to university, I studied philosophy because T.S. Eliot said you should study at university the things that you can't do by yourself. So I started to study things like logic and argument, etc., and knew when to strip away poetic metaphor. I actually now believe that good science writing, real science writing, tries to understand what it's writing about on its own terms and not use too many metaphors. I used every trick in the book I knew about writing prose in writing the book in terms of interweaving narrative. The science, it performs the function of what a novelist might call backstory. Like, you have to know when to switch into the science, not do it too long so people are not overwhelmed, and then switch back to the story. And, you know, the book is really a series of encounters with people who have usually clinicians, researchers, who have helped individuals rewire their brains. So it's I think, emotionally moving as you go through, because these clinicians had to struggle against their peers to get recognition, and the patients themselves had all sorts of great difficulties. And then I would slip in the science. So I'm proud to have written an esoteric neuroscience textbook that nobody knows they've been studying, but when you put the book down, it's my hope that a person's been quite updated on a lot of core science about the brain, the poetry issue was to know actually when to restrain it. Because, you know, there's so many people who have picked up books on Einstein and relativity, and they put them down. They don't really understand anything about Einstein and relativity. There's a few metaphors here and there, and they end up obscuring things. So it was a kind of negative guidance that I got from my poetic background for the science, but a positive guidance in terms of pacing the narrative and the emotional impact of the book, describing, you know, portraits of human beings who are struggling with these problems.
So, whoops, have you been able to play with the neuroplasticity of your own brain by responding, thinking, acting, and imagining?
I think so. I'm always trying different things, and so right now I'm doing something called the Tomatis technique.
Right now with me?
No, not with you.
Oh, okay.
Not without your permission. No, that's a kind of brain exercise that I'm doing. I'm doing the Posit Science program. The Tomatis technique is something that's interesting. He was a French ear, nose, and throat doctor who actually many broadcasters have tried to improve their listening and articulation skills with it. But it's also being used to help some children with pervasive developmental disorders. Some kids with autism benefits. Some kids with learning disorders benefit. And, you know, we have this left and right hemisphere, and certain things in general do better if they're going on in the left and others in the right. And sometimes with people, they're sometimes going on in the right places, in the wrong places rather, and you can kind of rewire this, and one hemisphere can be dominant when it shouldn't be. I like to think of the two hemispheres as like an old married couple, and one of them is, when one is working well, it inhibits the other. You know, it's like an old, you're not going to wear those plaid shorts again to the barbecue, and the other hemisphere says, okay, I won't wear them, but you're not going to talk about politics. And so sometimes you actually want the different brain departments to readjust. So that's something that I'm doing now, and it's very interesting. And I see the kids at the listening center, and some of them are doing very well. But I also apply the principles of neuroplasticity to my life more. And, you know, the most important one is to understand that development doesn't really stop at the end of early youth. I used to actually think that that was the case because biological development was thought to stop. But it doesn't. And so you can be very creative in the second part of your life. And your brain is much more likely to malfunction if you underuse it than overuse it. It's much more likely to wither away from neglect than it is to wear out from overuse. We've got thousands of experiments that show it's a use-it-or-lose-it brain right now. And really, as you get older, the best things that you can do, I describe a lot of them in the book, but are fine ways to stimulate your brain.
Like taking a total immersion language course or something.
Yes, and it's got to really be immersion.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that would be a fantastic thing to do. I often describe plasticity as like snow on a hill in winter. This, you'll forgive me, this is a metaphor. And I know what's wrong with it, but just between friends, I will use a metaphor. Because the snow is plastic and pliable, you can take many different paths down that hill. So plasticity can give rise to flexibility. But, you know, it can also give rise to rigidity because the snow is plastic and pliable. If you take a run down that hill when you're skiing down it and you had a good run, being human, you'll probably take a path similar to, or close to that first one the second and third time down. And because the snow is plastic and pliable, you'll start to get tracks or ruts. And that's what happens to us. We develop all sorts of habits that are very, very rigid. And then we extrapolate back onto our brain and say, well, I'm kind of rigid in my ways, and my friend is, and everybody I know is. So therefore, people's brains must be rigid. But that's a misunderstanding. So plasticity is actually contributed to, in a kind of way, to masking itself. And once you know this, you can find all sorts of ways around it.
I was intrigued by the story of Michelle in your book. And this is a woman, she's now an adult, who was born without the left hemisphere of her brain. I mean, it was completely not there. And this is the area where speech and verbal skills, and this is where it all takes place. She can talk. She can write. What has happened in her brain to allow her to do that?
Well, I went to see Michelle because I wanted to see, you know, My book is filled with very challenging cases of people who've rewired their brains, strokes, etc. But in some respects, Michelle is the most challenging. Something happened, something catastrophic happened when she was developing in the womb, and her left hemisphere just never developed. Now, we know that there's a lot of plasticity early on in the time of the development of the nervous system. But we really did believe, or many, many people believed, that there was this genetic predeterminism that would say speech must take place in the left hemisphere. Well, obviously it doesn't, because Michelle speaks perfectly normally. Look, we knew that sometimes in some people, a small percentage of the population, it takes place in the right. But all the left hemisphere functions that Michelle needed to survive moved over to the right or were taken by the right. And that just, that's such a powerful lesson. It just shows, first of all, that the brain does what it has to do to survive if there's enough cortical real estate to house it. It shows that the order in which you learn something is absolutely crucial. Michelle was had a lot of trouble moving around, and she had a lot of trouble with vision when she was very, very young. No one dreamed that she didn't have half her brain, and they didn't have brain scans when she was born. But for a child who was somewhat immobile, now she's quite mobile, compared to others, speaking was important. So speech established itself, if you will, in the part of the brain where most people have visual spatial processing. And if a child didn't have to move around a lot, the need for visual spatial processing wouldn't be as important. So now Michelle, as an adult, has some visual spatial processing, but she gets lost fairly easily. So that tells you that in the brain, a mental function is the most important thing. It's not so much the architecture. If you look at the brain, if you look at the cerebral cortex, which is the thin bark around the brain, it's got six layers wherever you look at it, the outside of your brain. It looks identical, and we never knew what to make of this. Well, it turns out that the part of your brain which we call the visual cortex, which is the occipital lobe at the very back of the brain, looks just like the part that processes touch or language. Now listen to this. If I was to take a blindfold, put it around your face, and create absolute darkness for 2 days, within a matter of hours, your so-called visual cortex at the back of your brain, which is supposedly pre-assigned to do vision, would start processing touch and language and sound, particularly sound more than language. Now, that's just remarkable. So it turns out these are very flexible operators, or find the word you want for it. But in Michelle's brain, what we see is that the most important activities would get into the right hemisphere and dominate it competitively. It's like they have squatter's rights. And that's an important thing for anybody to know about their brains, or when you're teaching children, that the things that you get in there first, because plasticity is competitive, are probably going to be dominant. It'll be harder to work around them. And, again, think of, you learn to speak English and then you will have an English accent when you go and speak French. It'll be hard to deal with that. I learned a lot from Michelle about the ordering of education and learning.
My guest is Norman Doidge. He is the author of The Brain That Changes Itself, Stories of Personal Triumph from the Frontiers of Brain Science. Norman, what social benefits do you think we could see as the idea of brain plasticity really takes hold in popular culture?
Well, I mean, they're immense. Though I alluded to the fact that adult life has to be reconceived. Psychology textbooks on development are usually about child or young adult development. We have to re-examine that completely. Education has to be modified, I think, or will benefit from being modified. When we talk about learning disorders, what we're usually talking about, let's say someone has trouble reading. Well, you use about 5 or 6 parts of your brain to read. You move your eyes across the page, you listen, you visualize, another part deals with meaning. A kid with a learning problem usually has problems in just one of those areas, and it varies from child to child. But because this is an information-based society, just a small area, a small traffic jam, if you will, in that part of the brain can have such a devastating impact. That was one of the reasons I got into this, too. I saw what was happening to children who had learning disorders when they got older and came to my office, and saw how incredibly demoralized and messed up they were. And some of them sensed that they were just so close to being able to do it, and yet something was blocking them. So I would see every child in Ontario, in Canada, having a brain-based assessment. It doesn't have to be all that complicated. And just go in and do just strategic exercises for those little areas that are going to mess them up terribly. If you want to go just very broadly and look at the implications of plasticity for culture, the humanities, the social sciences, any kind of training or education, I would say it's this, broadly understood. If you ask most people, what's the relationship between the brain and culture? They would say, well, the brain produces culture. It seems pretty simple. But what I argue is that's just half the story. The other half is that the culture in which you are acculturated actually wires up your brain in a particular way. And I've got a lot of experiments in there to show how true that is. And so there really are differences between cultures, and they start off as practices, but they become biological differences. And so that very non-productive debate that went on for about 100 years between nature and nurture, when anyone who noticed that different cultures seem to have different aptitudes, and if they dared to talk about it, they'd be accused of being racist or something like that. Well, it turns out that they were noticing something important, and they weren't necessarily racist. Just a very broad example. If you look at people who are raised in countries, cultures that descend from ancient China in some way, and you compare them to countries and cultures that descend from ancient Greece, they perceive things very differently. And I'm not talking about differences of opinion. If you show a still life to people from China, Korea, or Japan, and you ask them just to notice it, and then you ask them questions about it, they will do very, very well on documenting relationships. And this is not happening consciously. This is happening subliminally and too fast for consciousness. This is automatic. It's what we call perceptual learning. They'll be very good at relationships, but they won't be great compared to Westerners at documenting the prominent object. And it's vice versa for Westerners. And if someone is immigrating from, let's say, from Japan to the United States, it'll take about 3 years for them to begin to perceive it the way Americans perceive it, and vice versa if Americans go to Asia. So when you go from one culture to another, there are all the things we know about, that things people do things differently, have different opinions. But there's the stuff that we haven't been able to talk about, which is this unconscious wiring up of how our brains in different ways. There's a culture I talk about in the book about the sea gypsies, who basically hunt for morsels of marine life, and they dive 10 meters down. And the entire culture, all the children in the culture, can see clearly underwater. Now, Westerner, no one else can do that. And we thought that was based on a hardwired reflex. But this is something they're taught to do, see clearly underwater. And Western scientists have gone underwater with them, and they give them flashcards, they read them perfectly, and now they can teach it to Europeans. So, I mean, we're learning that so much that we thought was a given and hardwired isn't necessarily. That much, can I just say one sort of warning? I am not here to say that the brain is infinitely malleable or genetics are irrelevant. I think they're very, very important.
Have people accused you of that? Or?
No, but sometimes people listen to this very basically hopeful story and then start extrapolating into neuro-utopianism, as I call it.
That's sort of a human thing to do.
Yes. Well, Spinoza said we are buffeted about between hopes and fears, and when emotion's driving us, we tend to extrapolate. But I'm not here to replace an overly rigid view of the brain with an overly flexible one. I'm trying to get the middle and just a more accurate picture of what it's about. Most people who rewire their brains have to work very hard to do it. It's not a cinch. But man, oh man, is it worth it when you can do something like that.
You've been speaking all over the world, lots of conferences and so on. Has that rewired you? Has it changed you?
I don't think it's changed my personality. It's certainly been a very interesting experience to do so, basically. It's very pleasant and stimulating. I mean, at some level, it is good for my brain, because the two things that I've done most of my adult life have been writing, which is a fairly solitary activity, and sitting with one person and their issues and problems. And I do think novelty is a very good thing for the brain in general. So I'm feeling pretty perky these days.
Well, thank you, and continued success with the book. I think it's got the legs of a centipede. Norman Deutsch, thank you.
Thank you.